velvet claw. What it do is secure the record so when you scratch and the record won't get harmed at all.
And Kev, what do you have under there?
Okay, what I have under here is, you know, plastic and paper, which really shouldn't be used because it'll draw a film on your records. But the best thing I suggest to use is use a mat like him. It's called a felt. You can buy it at any record store because it doesn't cause a film under your records. The reason why it's paper, because if I'm speed mixing, I need to, you know, the slide, so it'll slide back and catch on. If I use mat, you know, felt, it won't, you know, catch like that. So the best thing to use, like he said, is felt. That's one thing I can really suggest to you.
Are there other questions before we talk with the rappers? Folks want to hear the rappers. I hear it. Okay. With us today, sitting to my left, two rappers with the Grandmasters of Funk, one of Philadelphia's finest rap groups from Mount Airy. They work with Cosmic Kev here. We've got next to me, Perry P. Next to him, Money Man. Maybe we should start by, Perry, why don't you explain, why don't you give us a little example to the folks of what a rap is, for those who don't know what we're talking about. And then what we'll do is we'll break down, just like we did with the DJ work, into different types of rap.
What, you want me to rap?
Just a short piece of a rap. So, Kev, can we get some music up there? And let's keep the music real low so we can hear
one,
the rap.
1, 2, 1, 2. 1, 2.
Now this is a rap that I'm just gonna make off the top of my head. And it's like this. All jet. For all your people night in the place, you gotta get up and feel the bass. And when I own the mic, I might give it a taste, because you know my rhymes are shock your race. Seeing soul dart fly, it's got to be quick. And when I'm on the mic, I put you in a fit. You know the beat, and just don't quit. And when I get on the ripples, and it go like this. See, rhymes so fast, rhymes not slow. Rhymes on the beat, won't let it go. When you hear the rhyme, you'll be amazed, because you know my rhyme and action put you all in a daze.
Perry earns his reputation. Okay, Perry, first of all, let's talk about the different types of rap. Well, actually, both you and Money Man, in terms of some people write their raps out, some people improvise their raps. How do y'all work?
Well, the rhymes I say I make up at the top of my head. See, Money Man just got in the group, like, you know, about a year ago, something like that. See, all the rhymes I say by myself. And a lot of people, you know, I got in a lot of battles and things, you know. I just like the rhyme.
Money Man, how about you? When you make up your raps, how do you do that?
Some of them are written, previously written, and others I say off my head.
Uh-huh.
Or you listen from others and you take some of what they say and then you add on what you have to say to it and you can make out with that.
Right, right. What are the different types of rapping?
Oh, it's slow-paced raps, fast-talking, fast raps, and then it's mainly MCing, where you just talk in between, you know, while the DJ's cutting. And my man Perry P, he has a whole different, completely different style. He changes his voice while he raps. He has 50,000 different voices, any kind of character, anything. He could change his voice while he's rapping.
It's also message rap, right?
Yes. When you're rapping, you're preaching a message to the people so they should understand what you're really telling them something. That no. Yeah, you rap about the environment or you tell them a message, something. Community, you can rap about the community. Different places, you can rap about yourself, but it's all a message that you should understand. It's just not no hip-hop stuff.
Okay, why don't we do real short examples of the different kinds of rap to give the people an idea of what we're talking about?
All right, well, this is MCing. In the place to be, to the highest degree, most definitely with personality, gots to be the almighty money. That's just MCing. Now, Paris going to do some space rapping.
1, 2. This is a form of rap that I made up myself with the different voices to see the people smile
for just a little while as you rock your ass with the stereo sitting around sounds of the Grandmasters of Funk. Now you're added to that you live.
really feeling. Now, this is how it goes. Now, everybody know you're in the place, and when I'm on the microphone, I rock the bass. I got a rhyme in store for you and more, and when I get on the beat, I'm down by law, cause the rhymes don't stop.
You just don't quit, and when I'm on the mic, I got the beat, and it's like this.
A message rap. Going through the ghetto. Hold up, hold up. Let me get it right. You're going through the ghetto with nothing to do. Say nothing changed and not for you. You're sitting around looking just like a clown. Going around, got your pants down. Ain't got no money, nothing to give. How will you work? Say, how will you live? It's automatic, systematic, remote control, synthetics, genetics, command your soul. Trucks, tanks, laser beams, guns, blasts, submarines, neutron, B-bomb, A-bomb, gas. All that stuff will kill you fast. A slow rap? See, I really don't have no slow raps. All right, this is a little speed rap. I'm the motivator, dominator, heartbreaker, boob shake, got the power, never stop, I always finish to devour, in that I break it down, I never quit it, like this, skip it, on the breaker, on the gym, on the joint, and when I rock all the beat, I keep the party going.
Rapping is most commonly associated with folks as with recordings. A lot of people nowadays hear rapping, they think of it as a recorded form, something that started off on records and then hit the street. Actually, one thing you learn real quickly in cities like Philadelphia or New York or D.C. or Baltimore is that it's just the other way around. The rapping started out on the street, started out at block parties, at clubs, with DJs working, first starting off doing MCing.
It started in New York.
Right. And developing from there into a recorded form and a commercial form so that the records keep infusing new ideas and new things into the street, but the same way the people in the clubs and the block parties are coming up with new stuff all the time. Now, in terms of how popular rapping is in Philly, how many groups would y'all say there were there working now?
In Philly?
Yeah.
500. It's a lot of 5,000. It's everywhere you look, it's a DJ, you know. Everybody want to be a DJ. That's what I say. I call them wannabes and sucker MCs and stuff like that, you know, to make them stop. Because we pulled up on a lot of people and made them look bad, you know. That'll make them stop. Because it's people, right, that go out there and they rap like this. Well, my name is Tom. I'm on the mic. I got a beat. I'm doing right. I ride the beat. And people be like, what is he saying? What is he saying? It's no strong message to it, like, you know, like screaming and, you know, getting into it so the people know what you're talking about. No, and it's a lot of other people to be like, what did he say? You can't understand their words. That's, you know.
Okay, unfortunately, we have run out of time in the workshop. But at 4:15 on the main stage, the Grandmasters of Funk are going to be on for about a half hour doing nothing but rapping.
That's right.
And then, joining them on the stage will be the Scanner Boys, who are going to do both popping and breakdancing. So let's have a big hand for the Grandmasters of Funk and Grand Wizard Sly. We'll see y'all at 4:30 over there if you want to see more of this, or stay here for the next workshop.
Hey, watch it now. It's going to be all free right down there. Come on down and watch what we're going to do. Hey, watch it now. Watch this stage right here now. Ladies and gentlemen, where your next attraction take place right here. Come on down and watch what they're going to do right here. Come on. Right down and close. Bring the engine rubber lady out. Watch it now. It's going to be all free. Come right down and close and sit down. Yeah, you're going to get something free. You don't get much free when you come out, so you better come on down and get some of it. Hey, watch it now. It's going to be all free right here. Now, I know you heard your friends and neighbors talking about this. This is what right here. You're in the right place. This is what they was talking about. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you come right on down and close, or come right down and have a seat, the reason that we ask you to come down and have a seat, it's against the fire regulation for us to block the back and have the front open. So come on down. Right down and close now, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, tell them to bring the snake girl out here. The girl on the roller skates. Watch it now, ladies and gentlemen. We're getting ready to do a workshop here. This is the workshop from the tent over there with the blue tents over there. This is the workshop from it. So we're going to tell you a little about what to do over there and what to expect when you go over there. Now, they got a show over there, ladies and gentlemen. When you go over there and you see it, you go home and tell all your friends and neighbors about it. Because this is the one. And if you read your paper, it's in the paper about that show over there. That's the one you read about and hear I'm talking about. So now we're going to turn you back over to the man that, you know, brought us all here. He went to a great expense to bring us here. 50 cents apiece.
You may walk away from that other stage thinking that you know all there is to know, thinking that you've seen all there is to see over there in the performance. See a little bit of breakdancing, hear some gospel music, hear a little bit of doo-wop and some vocal harmonies. But you really don't know what you've seen until you come to this stage, because on this stage, we're going to tell you what it all means. So when you go home, when you're all through, you go home and tell your friends and neighbors and say, what we've got for you here, you can say, I not only saw him, but I heard him talk. And more specifically, I know what I'm talking about now because I heard him on the workshop stage. So here we are at the workshop narrative stage for the Black Philadelphia program here at the Festival of American Folklife. Now, what we're going to be doing today, this particular workshop, is going to deal with traditions of black entertainment. Willie Jones here, right next to me, a fellow more commonly known in Philadelphia as Ashcan Jones, has a long and varied career on the stage. He's worked with everything from circuses and carnivals to medicine shows and black traveling tent shows. Worked with minstrelsy, worked with vaudeville, been in the movies, been on the stage. How many people do you know who can say that at one period of life they were working with an old medicine doctor selling medicine, and on another were appearing with other Lindy Hoppers in the Marx Brothers movie Duck Soup? That's right, ladies and gentlemen. This gentleman right next to me as a movie star as well, as a Lindy Hopper, and during that period of his life, was in a number of feature films, many of which you're probably familiar with. But that's not what we're here to talk about. What we're going to be speaking about today, more specifically, is traditions of entertainment. Now, when you come to a folk festival, a festival of folk life such as this, you expect to hear about folk culture, you expect to hear about the old times, but you don't expect to hear that much about commercial entertainment, tent shows, vaudeville, theater. Yet we have to realize that, especially in the black community, the traditions of music, of dance, of comedy that we see on the stage were often traditions that were born in the folk community, brought onto the stage and developed there into new forms that became traditions themselves, except traditions of the stage. Traditions that were passed down from older generation of performer to younger generation of performer. Not mother to son, or mother to daughter, or father to son, father to daughter, but rather older comic to younger comic, older dancer to younger dancer. With us here is Willie Jones. Willie started off on the entertainment circuit as a dancer when he was quite a young man, and then traveled literally the entire circuit. Willie, could we start by talking about how you started as a dancer, where you were, how you first got on showbiz, and then the different stages of show business that you've worked with?
Well, I started in show business. I was, I went to see a carnival. And I saw the carnival. I liked what the people was doing. And I was on the farm. I can tell you, I was down in Georgia. And we was on the farm. And I saw those people dancing and carrying on. So I asked them, could I go to the store for them? So I went to the store for them. They let me go to the store for them. When they got ready to leave, they let me go with them. At first, I went to the store, and I watched what they did. And when they really need somebody to do something, I was there to do it. So that's my first way of getting away from home. I went away with a carnival. And then later on, then I started learning how to dance. I wanted to be a dancer, so I tried to learn how to dance. But I wanted to tap dance, and I found out I couldn't learn how to tap dance. So I learned a dance to call the Lindy Hop. I don't guess any of y'all ever heard of it, because that's why we hear the tale about this, because they took the Lindy Hop from us and turned it into the jitterbug. So that everybody, y'all know the jitterbug, but you don't know the Lindy Hop. The Lindy Hop was the first one. It was the Lindy Hop. But they took it from us and turned it into the jitterbug. So it wouldn't be our dance, but somebody else's dance. When we did it, it's just like the break dance today. You go someplace, they got a big sign up there, no break dancing here, because they say you tear up everything. So when I was young, when we would do the Lindy Hop, they would have it in there. They wouldn't call it the Lindy Hop. They said, no part of the Big Apple did here. Because everybody thought the Big Apple and the Lindy Hop were the same, but it was different. You did Lindy Hop, Big Apple was a dance that you did everything like you see them doing today on this, on that, what, Saturday Night something. The guy have the Saturday Night Show, what is it there? Saturday Night Fever. Well, see, that's what the Big Apple was years ago. They did the same thing years ago, but it was called the Big Apple. You could do anything you wanted to do. But the Lindy Hop, you had to do one special dance. You couldn't turn the girl loose no longer, and you could turn around and back. But now you just turn them loose, you do what you want to do, and they do what they want to do. It's a lot of different than dances now, but they still call it partner dances. But it's not partner dance no more. Anytime you turn the hand, take the hand loose from a girl, more than time than you can turn around, it's no more partners.
Willie, you started off with the carnival then, trying to be a dancer, right?
Oh, yeah. I tried to be a dancer with the carnival, but I couldn't.
Now, one thing that people, when they think about carnivals nowadays, folks tend to think of rides and gambling and games. But now you're talking about dancing on a carnival. Could you tell us a little bit about where you would dance on a carnival and how carnivals were different in those days?
Well, at that time, when a carnival come to town, they had to have a black show. At that time, we didn't call it a black show. We called it a minstrel show, or a plantation show, or a jig show. You had to, one of them. But see, you couldn't come to town with just rides and games at that time, because you had a lot of people didn't ride, you had a lot of people didn't play the game. But they saved up all the year to go to that show, and they would come in and see that minstrel show, they call it the plantation show, or the black show, or the colored show. They call it all kind of show then. But the carnival had to have one with them then, but today they don't have to have them. See, they can come in with rides and things, but you couldn't come in just rides and games at that time. So that's why you had so many comedians, so many show people at that time. But now, what you see, if you ever go in that tent and see what I do, you hardly ever see it today.
So there was an entirely different tradition of carnivals, that of including entertainment, a special top, a special tent. It had nothing but a show in it, a show that included music, dance, and humor, the sort of comedy that Willie Jones still does. Now, Willie started as a dancer with carnivals, but really didn't stay with carnivals all that long time before he had jumped onto another form of entertainment. Where did you go after carnivals as a dancer, but before you went on to do the Lindy Hop?
Well, I went on to New York then. I went to New York to learn, and now I went with a vaudeville show. Me and a guy named Snake Hip Davis, I was trying to do another dance. I finally couldn't tap dance. I tried to do a snake hip, a wiggle dance. Well, he was good at it, and I was good, but I wasn't good as him, because I did a lot of comical dancing, and then no time. And when they really wanted somebody to do something, when they I thought I was good, and they took me away from there. They found out I didn't know time. So then I lost out there. So I've taken 6 months to learn music and time so I would be a dancer. And from that day on, I started working, dancing, but I was doing the Lindy Hop, but I wasn't doing this. And I got older. I couldn't throw the girls around. The girls couldn't throw me around. So I started doing comedies because I wanted to stay in the show business.
Well, you say that before you did Lindy Hop, you worked on a vaudeville show. Were you showing inside at that time or working under tent at all?
Oh, no, I was showing theaters and clubs all over the world and auditoriums, yeah.
Okay. So the first thing that becomes real clear then is the link between the type of show that you were doing on the carnival and what was happening at that time in black vaudeville, a real close tie, the same kind of entertainment.
Oh, yeah, it was the same entertainment.
Now, another form that borrowed the same entertainment was that of the minstrel show. Now, a lot of people, when they hear minstrel shows, automatically think of the 1800s, think of white people who would put on blackface, would cork up their faces so that they would look black, and then would do comic routines caricaturing the dance, the humor, the music of the black man. In the 1900s, however, a number of black troupes developed which did the very same thing. Among them, Silas Green, the Florida Blossom Minstrels, and others. Willie, could you tell us a little bit about what was a minstrel show, and from having worked with the Florida Blossoms for a while?
Well, the minstrel show, we used to have what we call one-night stands. They would play here tonight, and there'd be someplace tomorrow night and someplace the next night. And they had a lot of people working. They had 50 or 60 people working. They had people to put up these tents like this. Those people would go there, they take it down the night and put it up the next day, and you wake the next day. You did a lot of traveling. That's what they call one-night stand. You hear a lot of good people say, now, I'm like the Florida Blossom or the Brown Skin Models or the Silas Green Show, one-night stand. When a guy talking to a girl talking to a boy, say, you only got a one-night stand. That's where that word one-night stand come from, because they did one night.
Now, what sort of entertainment exactly, how would a minstrel show run, let's say, from beginning to end, to give an idea of what sort of things you'd see if you went to such a show?
Well, if you went to a minstrel show, they would open up with a band. Next, you would have a line of girls dance. And next, you would have what we call a principal. It may be a tap dancer, it may be a singer, somebody doing something. Some of them be doing tricks and things. But that the next will come a chorus. And then you'll come again, a tap dancer, a comedian, and then you go again. And in the middle, that's where the band would take its hold. You have a band, and that band would play and let you feel them. And then whoever the star was would come on after that.
So you'd close out with a star?
You close, the whole show closed, right. But the star would be the last one to come on. Right. Who's never even starring, that would be the last one to come on. And after the star, then they bring the whole act called the finale. Everybody come on and do a finale.
So basically, when we're talking about minstrel shows in this century, we're really talking about full-scale stage shows. Shows that carried comics, shows that carried a band, carried singing stars, all working under a tent and showing one-night stands all through, especially the southern states and the East Coast states. The connection then is clear between vaudeville, between carnivals, between minstrelsy and tent shows, minstrel tent shows, other form of tent shows. There's another form that is closely linked to all of these, though, in a rather strange way, that of the medicine show. Now, Willie, you worked a little sort of on and off in your later years when you were doing carnival with some medicine showmen. How did that work? What was a medicine show to you?
Well, a medicine show was a doctor. He made his own medicine. He would sell liniment. And that liniment would anything hurt you, it was supposed to cure it. Then he would have capsules, whatever it was. Don't care what you had, that's what you bought for it. It would cure it. But the thing about it, he would have a big thing just like this. You didn't pay no money to come in to see that. He would have the big show, and after he have the show, then he make his medicine pitch. He sell medicine. but he'll pay his performers out of the money he make out of his medicine.
Unlike most of the other forms, medicine shows were more often than not white-owned with black entertainers appearing on them. It was very hard for a black doctor to really operate in many of the areas, especially in the South, to manage a show because you'd run into too much trouble down there. There were only two or three shows. Doc Robinson's not, no, Doc Robinson.
Yeah, Doc Robinson Minstrels, yeah.
Doc Robinson Minstrels.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There were a few shows that were all black medicine shows. More often what you had was mixed and white medicine shows that would employ one or two black entertainers that might have come from the minstrel stage, might have come from the carnival stage, might have come from any of a variety. There's one other area I think we should talk about and show those links. In speaking about vaudeville, maybe we're going to get wet.
Yeah, we better.
I think so. Yeah. Maybe we can talk a little bit about Irvin C. Miller's Brown Skin Models and the role that you played in that, and then how, so what happened to Irvin C. Miller and Florida Blossom to show how closely linked a lot of these things were.
Well, the Brown Skin Models show was a theater show. But right after World War II, you didn't have no theaters to work in because they had done, wasn't showing up with pictures there. They didn't need you, that's what it really was. They used to take shows and so they could make more money. But after the war, they didn't need you. They was making plenty of money, and everybody had plenty of money. So the Brown Skin Models brought the Florida Blossom, which were a tent show. So we'll still have some place to work. So we was working on the tent. That's what made them buy that show, because we couldn't go into the theater. The theaters didn't need us. That's what it was. Yeah, we're
still here.
Yeah.
So what happened to Irvin C. Miller? Here we had a traveling stage show that ultimately bought out a tent show, a minstrel show, went under tent, under canvas, continued to tour like that. Where did they go from there?
Well, he went back in the theaters. He stayed out there a year and he didn't like it. He went back in the theaters, and after he went back in the theaters, it's still, vaudeville we had used to be a week. It went from a week to 3 days. It went from 3 days to 1 day. Then it went from 1 day to just one midnight show. And you would have to move another place for that. So after that, he went out of business. And he told me, he said, you've been handling my show, so don't wait for nobody else, get your own show. That's when I went to the carnival with my own show. And I just closed the carnival 3 years ago. I retired from it.
So basically, the story is one that comes full circle. Willie Jones started off working with circuses and carnivals, especially carnivals, as a dancer in the plantation top on the shows. Went from there to doing some vaudeville tent show work and vaudeville theater work. Went there into Lindy Hop, which was inside club work and theater work and movies. From there, still as a Lindy Hop dancer, into the vaudeville stage show Irvin C. Miller's Brown Skin Models, which in turn bought out a minstrel show. Went under canvas, traveled on the road under canvas until they went back to theaters and then ultimately closed the show down, at which point Willie went back to where he started in some ways on carnivals, except now, instead of working as a dancer with carnivals, he was the owner and manager of his own carnival show. There's one more thing I want to mention here, Willie.
One more thing, okay. I want to tell them about here. Now, I work here. I have worked the theater here. I don't know whether y'all remember it, but I worked the National Theater here with Walter Houston and Knickerbocker Holiday. I worked here with the carnival on Benning Road. That's where they used to put up with James E. Straight shows. I know a lot of you heard that show because it still comes here, the James E. Straight show. I worked here with them. And then we had a big theater down on, I think it was 7th and T. Everybody heard of that. You hear the Howard in Washington. We would play the Royal in Baltimore, the Howard in Washington, the Earl in Philadelphia, the Apollo in New York. And we did that year round.
there's one more thing I'd like to mention. Those who have come to the festival and see you performing on the main stage have probably noticed that this gentleman is a comic, Willie Ashcan Jones. Well, we've only talked so far about dancing here on the stage, and you starting off as a dancer and being a Lindy Hopper and going from here and there. How was it that you became a comic, and how does that fit into this transformation in show business?
Oh, I said that I got too old to dance. You know, I was we were throwing girls around. I was doing the Lindy Hop, and we were throwing girls around, and girls throwing us around. If any, no, it's not anybody old enough out there. If you saw Date the Razor with the Marx Brother, Hells a Poppin' with Olsen and Johnson, Melody Go Round with Martha Ray, I was in that picture. I was with Chick Webb, the short. Beat the Drum with Chick Webb, Your Feet Too Big with Fats Wallace, and with the brown skin model, Wonder Where My Gal Is Tonight.
As a comic, from whom did you learn, and how did you go about becoming a comic?
Oh, when I found out I was getting too old to dance, it was an old fella named William Earl was working with me, and I learned from him. And when he died, he got sick first before he died, and I had to take his place. And we had Rastus Murray. He's a late comic, was very good. Everybody might have heard of him. And he said to me, William Earl, while he was sick, he told me to go out there and do comedy and do what he did. He had told me once not to never do it, but he got sick and told me to do everything what he do and go out there and don't be scared of Rastus Murray, and I would make it. And I went out there and did it, but he died about 2 weeks later than that. But he left me a living.
That's one thing that you rarely see at a folk festival or you rarely hear tell of, that of a professional entertainment tradition being passed on within the entertainment form. Really the way that most of our entertainers in this field learned and stayed in it, it wasn't that they were learning from parents or necessarily older people. It's often that they were learning from people who were the immediate generation above them in the entertainment field. People with whom they worked as colleagues on the stage and from whom they learned the older traditional routines. So that now when you see Willie doing comedy here, what you see is really his version of a number of the routines done by Willie Earl and the older comics, yep, who in turn had performed those on minstrel stages and traveling tent show and medicine show stages and learned them from older comics before them. So it's an entire hidden tradition, a tradition that finds its expression only on the stage and found its development really in black traditions of entertainment in the black traveling stage. Are there any questions before we close out the workshop for Willie? If there aren't, I'd like to just mention that following this workshop immediately, we're going to stay in the vein of performance traditions of the black stage with a workshop on the art of tap dancing. Appearing on the stage will be master tapper LaVon Robinson, 57-year-old tap dancer who learned on the streets of Philly and got quite a lot of experience in vaudeville and in late vaudeville and nightclubs, and his two accompanists, colleagues who once were students, Jermaine Ingram and Sandra Janoff. So while we wait for them to come on over and get the stage set up for the next workshop, let's please have a hand for Willie Ashcan Jones.
The dance tradition within the black American experience, we have a wide variety of dance forms, of which we've seen some more contemporaneous, the stepping, and of course the break dancing. And then we also are fortunate to have another form endemic to blacks, the tap. And I wonder if we could just start by giving the artist a chance to give us some historical sociological statements on the evolution or the origin of that particular form, this form. Mr. Robinson is handing the mic to...
Well, I want to give it to somebody that know what they're talking about.
That's why we have you having the mic. Okay.
Thank you very large. Number one, my name is LaVon Robinson. This is Jermaine Ingram and Sandy Janoff. Did I pronounce that right? Right, right. And we started tap dancing at a young age. Well, I started tapping at a young age. She told me to speak for myself. She one of them South Philadelphia smarties. And tap was always learned on the street. You learn how to tap dance on the street, not in no schools, because they didn't have no schools at that time, and the schools that they did have, you couldn't afford to go nohow. So you hung on the streets in the evenings and watched all the other tap dancers that danced on the street, and you learned in that fashion. I've been dancing for, at that time, when I learned how to dance on the street, I had been dancing about 3 months, you know, and I picked it up vaguely until I start hanging with the master dancers. Mm-hmm. And we had quite a few master tap dancers in Philadelphia at that time. Am I right, sir? Good. Well, they wasn't just black dancers now. You had a lot of white master tap dancers in Philadelphia that would challenge, come down in the Back Bay area of Philadelphia and challenge the black dancers, and we would go down into the white area and challenge the white dancers. And we would all meet at Broad and South outside of Pep's Bar. Or back in the little street behind the Lincoln Theater, or either Cater Street. Now that they have remodeled that street and everything, they don't call it Cater Street no more. It's Cartier Street. No. Spelt the same, but pronunciation was changed. You know, they put a little pizzazz in it, you know, and call it Cartier Street now, you know. Yeah, right. You remember them days. You was out there tap dancing at that time, you know. Yep. When they had the dance teams, they must have had about 1,000 dance teams in Philadelphia at that time. They had teams like Breakfast, Dinner, and Supper. They had teams like Pot, Pan, and Skillet. I mean, these were really tap dance teams. They had teams like, you know these, the Clark Brothers, right? The Nicholas Brothers, right, right, right. And all these teams were pretty good tap dancers.
Well, I wonder if two lovely ladies chime in at a time, but we notice that, say, with break dancing, you have certain obligatory moves, the moonwalk, the helicopter. Are there any particular steps, let's see, you say you're studying with the master dancers or something like that, but tapping steps that are sort of your, the foundation upon which the art form is built?
Yeah, there are certain steps. Well, for one thing, every tap dancer has his or her favorite time steps. Mm-hmm. And time steps are just what it sounds like. They're steps made to set the time so that the other dancers or the accompaniment knows what the tempo is and knows what the meter is. And, you know, they're basic steps. It's funny, when I started dancing with LaVon, he didn't know these, you know, I start talking about, you know, the nomenclature, and he said, what's that? I said, well, a ball change. He said, you said a ball and chain? So the nomenclature didn't make any difference. I guess the nomenclature came along when tap dance began being taught in organized schools. But, you know, the people on the street, you know, didn't necessarily rely on the nomenclature. You had to pick it up by seeing it. You picked it up by seeing it and by the sound. I guess mostly by the sound, because there's a lot in tap dance that you can't see. Mm-hmm. And you have to know the sound. You have to internalize the sound in order to learn it. But there, you know, there are shuffles, there are wings, riffs, skiddly bops. Yeah, I mean, that's some of the vocabulary of the dance. What's distinctive, I think, about the way that LaVon dances and the way that we've begun to learn is the paddle. If you see other tap dancers around the country, you very rarely see them dance with the close paddle that LaVon dances. That's the fast paddle back that goes from heel and toe back and forth, single paddles, double paddles, triple paddles that you see LaVon execute so marvelously on the stage that you've seen the past couple of days. And that's really kind of distinctive in LaVon's style of dancing. I was in New York about a couple of years ago at a tap dance seminar, and Charlie Cook, who dances with an old team called Cook and Brown, and knew I was in Philadelphia, and I put on my shoes and started dancing, and he said, "Oh yeah, you like them paddles, don't you? You must know LaVon Robinson." So that was an indication to me that that how distinctive paddling is and how much LaVon is associated with that style.
Thank you very much.
Let this lady add something here. You've been sitting,
not
saying anything.
One of my favorite stories is LaVon's learning the paddle for the first time. I don't even know if I can tell it as well. Do you want to tell that story?
You can tell it. It's all right. You're doing fine.
The story just has an image for me. The particular details have to do with his being in the Army and not quite getting back on the day when he was supposed to be back, but that has nothing to do with tap dancing. And he was with a friend, Henry Meadows, who was also a master dancer, and they were on the street at 16th and Lombard, underneath a streetlight. And I always picture these two young guys, one teaching the other how to do a paddle by the light of a streetlight. And I love that image. And that's become LaVon's signature.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Nicholas brothers. And I would assume that each of the, as you say, dancer has his signature or his style. You mentioned the tempo by which they dance. Could you say, looking back at Bojangles Robinson, what was it about him that made him such an exceptional dancer?
You talking about the master, Bill Robinson? Well, I think what made Bill Robinson so exceptional as far as dancing was concerned, that he was even-footed. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever he did on one foot, he did on the other. I mean, he was not a one-foot dancer. He was very clean, all the taps you could hear, you know, and nothing was muffled, you know. And Bill Robinson could run fast backwards than a lot of people could run fast frontwards. I mean, this is a fact about the man. You know, a lot of people don't know the history because the man passed away before a lot of your old people got a chance to know the man. But the man was not just a good tap dancer. The man was also a pool shark. The man was a track star. You know, the man was very athletic, very sportsmanlike, you know, and one of the greatest dancers that I ever seen, you know.
Okay, how would you, the twins, those are, well, one is going into acting now, contemporaneously, the Hines and Dad.
I didn't know they were twins.
Well, the Hines brothers.
Oh, you're talking about Gregory Hines and Maurice Hines.
Yes.
What was you saying about them?
No, well, I would say in terms of their style of dancing. I know that you mentioned the Nicholas brothers earlier, and I know that the splits was one thing that the one of the brothers was famous for. I guess he was the one that sang soprano. But anyway, well, what about the Hines brothers?
Well, I think the Hines brothers, dancers that came along, they came along into the last end of, you know, that tap thing when people were learning to tap. They were the last to come along, very young, and they learned a lot from a lot of dancers that they have seen. And I think that they're upcoming to be one of the future great tap dancers, mm-hmm. you know, because they got a lot of time to learn. You understand what I mean? And both of them have very good singing voices. Okay. See, and this helps. You know, when you mention the Nicholas brothers, see, there's so many different styles of tap dancing. Mm-hmm. See, now the Nicholas brothers was acrobatic flash tap dancers. You know, Bill Robinson was the greatest buck dancer in the world. You know, that's when, and the only thing changed about dancing was the name. Buck dancing and tap dancing, it's all the same. But the name changed from buck dancing to tap dancing. You know, that's all it is. A lot of people say, what's the difference between buck dancing and tap dancing? Is there a difference? There's no difference. Only thing changed is the name. You know.
I think we would entertain some questions from the audience, if you have any. As you're thinking of them, I'd like to just put an anecdote in to reinforce what you're saying about Robinson being able to run faster backwards and some forwards. At one time, he was the owner of the New York Black Yankees, and they would have doubleheaders there in Yankee Stadium. And one of the, if not promos, at least one of the
That's
big
right.
publicity events, he would get the youngsters, a group of youngsters, and in front of Yankee Stadium leading there, and for a block, he would beat them backpedaling, and they're running as fast as they can forward. There are some pictures of that. So just a little anecdote to underscore that. Are there some questions? Yes.
I got to know in Florida. I met Bill Cosby once. He was an upcoming comic when I met him. We were working a club next to each other. And I had a chance to see just what he was about for a little while, you know. But Bill Cosby is a very funny man, you know. Yeah, his comedy is right off the streets. You know, he's an intellect. You can say that. You can say that. You can say that. My pleasure.
Are there other questions from the audience? Any other persons? After all, you have these master dancers here, and it would be nice. Yes. No. Just sit. Well, if you get a program, but this is the workshop area, and we're having a workshop. These three artists are tap dancers. And they perform on the main stage. They have performed for the day, so you won't see them perform. But they're here talking about their